there was like security at the door and he's like, oh, don't worry about it. We're sound check or whatever, you know, and just kind of went all the way up to the front of this massive room and stage, like just acting like he belonged there, right? And picked up the microphone, made a little announcement, something like, you know, sound check one, two, you know, something like that. And then, and then left. And I was like, what the hell was that?
Hey everybody, welcome to a new episode of Venture Europe with me, Colleen Fabry. Our guest today is Lina Chong, partner at Target Global. Target Global is one of the leading European venture capital investors with more than 3 billion euro in assets under management and offices across Berlin, London, Tel Aviv, and Barcelona. They have backed more than 15 unicorns, including household names such as Delivery Hero, Revolut, WeFox, Flink, TravelPerk, and many others. Lina was named partner at Target earlier this year after working her way up from associate level. An American transplant in Berlin, she leads Target's German operations and co-leads the fund's early stage strategy. She's also a two-time founder herself, having started two companies, one in Southeast Asia and the other based in Germany and US. One was later sold to Living Social. During this episode, we discuss her move to Germany from the US, how they assess investment opportunities at Target Global, and the importance to surround yourself with people that you admire. This was by far the most personable and insightful interview that we have done. I really think you'll like it. Before we get started, let's hear from our sponsors, which make this show possible. This episode is brought to you by Rose, the spreadsheet where data comes to life. Connected with your business data and delightful to share, Rose is how teams work with numbers and share their results. Head to rose.com/ventureeurope and find out how you can easily manage your cap table, plan your next fundraising round, or import data from your favorite tools. I already moved my spreadsheet to Rose and you can too. See for yourself how you can make your data come to life for free and visit rose.com/ventureeurope. That is ROWS.com/ventureeurope. I have already prepared some templates like cohort analysis, fundraising tracker, and cap table management, which I'm sure you'll find useful. This episode is also brought to you by Athletic Greens. If you're like me and travel a lot and sometimes have hectic days, AG1 will become your most reliable friend. AG1 further covers my bases with vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced micronutrients that support gut health and the immune system. I'm a sucker for morning routines and I started using AG1 3 months ago. One scoop, 250 milliliters of water, 75 high quality ingredients perfectly crafted to be well absorbed by the body for a strong start of the day every day. With the 90-day money-back guarantee, you can test AG1 completely risk-free for 3 months. If you find that it doesn't meet your needs, you can get your money back, no questions asked. Right now, Athletic Greens is offering you, dear listeners of the Venture Europe podcast, a free year's supply of vitamin D3 and K2, which contributes to the maintenance of bones, teeth, muscle, and immune system, plus 5 AG1 travel packs when signing for a monthly membership. Visit athleticgreens.com/ventureeurope. Try it risk-free for 90 days, support your nutrient supply, and start a new healthy routine. Top health experts and performers like Tim Ferriss, Andrew Huberman, and Lewis Hamilton recommend Athletic Greens. It also tastes great. Visit athleticgreens.com/ventureeurope to taste for yourself. But thank you very much for coming over on the Venture Europe show. We had actually, I think, like 5 minutes or 10 minutes before this. You were like super prepared, asking all these questions. And I was like, can I do this? And can I do this? Also, you told me that you're in a hotel room. How come?
I am. Yeah. So I'm in a hotel room. I'm at a conference. It's the Mobile World Congress 4 years from now in Barcelona in Spain. So I'm kind of in between a lot of, you know, social engagements. It's really energizing. I really like the social aspect of this work. It's been a fairly long week, to be honest. So, but I'm feeling good. It's really nice. Barcelona is beautiful. So yeah.
Where are you heading next? Or when is the conference over? What's home for you?
Yeah, home is Berlin. So I'm actually headed probably to Poland. It's kind of a last minute, you know, I'm visiting a team there. I'm pretty excited about what they're building. So I just decided last night, actually, like, why don't I just fly to Poland or somehow try to go there and do that for a day. So I'll be in Poland end of this week before heading to Berlin, which is where I'm usually situated.
how much flexibility actually do you have in working with some teams if you just decided last night or like, yeah, I just want to go to Poland because they're working on this amazing thing and I just want to go and visit the team? How do you actually balance your time between new investments, working with portfolio companies, working with teams?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's, you know, I think it's a lot about how excited I am about the opportunity. I do try to spend a lot of my time with portfolio company. It kind of comes in seasons, I feel, like on the portfolio management side, typically like quarters or months where a lot of our companies and founders want to go out and fundraise, or, you know, there's like board meeting season, right? So after Christmas, like usually around January, there's like all of these board meetings. So it kind of depends on the month or the quarter. But yeah, I have a lot of flexibility to decide what is important. It's a fairly independent job. Ultimately, it's about what outcomes I can show, what results I can show. So I just try to manage myself in such a way where I'm really kind of going after the right things and not everything. But it's a difficult balance, to be honest.
What have you learned from pursuing, let's say, a better way to manage oneself?
I think a couple things, actually. So one is checking in with myself almost on a daily basis. Like, why am I doing this? Or why is this the priority today? Or does this like really move the needle? What is that needle I need to move, right? So I think having regular check-ins with myself, I found really changed the game for me in terms of kind of focus and keeping things simple also, right? And productivity in general. You know, the other thing I learned, and this is a little bit more from my operating days, was I wasn't very good with like sharing my Legos. I was the oldest sister. So I grew up with a sister and then, you know, I have some siblings and half siblings. I wasn't the best at sharing my toys. So when it became like when I, you know, started my own businesses, for example, I felt that I needed to kind of do everything, right? So actually delegating and working with people that I not just only trust, right? But people that I admire and I respect. And I'm like, okay, whatever you decide, you know, maybe not always, but typically what you decide is something I can also get on board with, or we can have an open conversation about, right? So I think delegating is one of the key lessons that I learned, especially in my early kind of operating career, that hugely helped me. And in this job as well, right? So many things you can do all the time, kind of training and working closely with my analysts and the rest of my team members, I think is really, really important to being productive.
And you mentioned delegating and checking in. How do you check in? Do you have a notebook or like a diary? I actually have like this diary, like a multi-purpose thing. And every evening I kind of write down, you know, what I have to focus. And I kind of found out that if I do it in the evening, it's much better if I do it in the morning, because in the morning I'm just in this execution mode. So I'm not a good planner. How do you do it?
Yeah, I have kind of a similar system. So it's an analog journal. It follows a little bit this idea of the bullet journal. I don't know if you have heard of this. Effectively, it's kind of a place where you just brain dump like everything that's on your mind. So you kind of are able to empty, right, all of these thoughts and to-dos and the things that if you like leave them in your mind too long, at least for me, creates some level of kind of low-grade anxiety, like, oh shit, I have so many things to do now. So I just kind of brain dump, and then I start to do a quick check-in in the evenings as well as the mornings. In the evenings, I kind of reflect more on the day and a little bit for the next day. And in the mornings, I kind of have a different kind of productivity routine where I'm more, you know, hyping myself up for the day, right? And really kind of seeing, yes, all right, was this really the right priority set, right? So I do have just very short check-ins twice a day with myself. It's been really helpful.
I just got to ask this because I'm doing the same, but how do you hype yourself up in the morning?
I tell myself a couple things, right? I think I'm the kind of person where, you know, you mentioned I like over-prepare, and, you know, I think generally I take myself a little bit too seriously, and it's, you know, kind of silly, right? Like, in the end, like, it doesn't really matter, right? No one actually cares. Like, I'll even forget, like, in a couple of weeks or tomorrow, right? I am just that kind of person. So some of the things that I need to remind myself of every morning is, look, you know, don't take yourself too seriously. And, like, you know, just say yes or just do the thing, right? Like, don't overthink things, right? Like, it's just a couple of things that I've learned from self-discovery over the years that, yeah, I just need to remind myself of. And It really helps me out. It helps me kind of get into the office and get into the day with like a pretty, you know, just measured and more relaxed mood.
You mentioned that your home is Berlin, and I just checked your profile. I was wondering, how does someone that did high school and uni in California end up in Berlin?
Yeah, it just kind of happened, to be honest. There was no big grand plan behind it, and it was actually quite last minute. So I graduated with a philosophy, law, and society degree in 2008. So people were not hiring philosophy majors, and like pretty much no one was hiring in 2008. I wanted to become a lawyer. I had a job at a law firm. I took my LSAT, right, which is a law entrance exam. And the day, actually the afternoon of my LSATs, like I took my LSATs in the morning, and that afternoon I decided like, I really don't want to do this for a living. Like I had huge amounts of respect for the lawyers I worked with. You know, some of my friends are like very, very good lawyers. I have huge amount of respect for the job. It just wasn't right for me. And I just decided to leave everything. I moved out of LA. I quit my job. I actually scored pretty well on my LSATs, but you know, I said, screw it, you know, and I moved to San Francisco, Bay Area. I was like crashing on a bunch of people's couches. And one of the places where I lived, I had a roommate who was from Germany, from Bonn. And he told me about, you know, education in Germany and Europe, which is practically free. And I'm like, you're freaking kidding me. Like, I need to check it out, right? So I just applied to a couple programs across Europe. And ended up getting a fellowship to study in Germany. The slightly also untold story there was I met a German guy, not the same guy, a different German guy at the time. And we started dating and he lived in Hamburg. So that definitely factored into my decision at that time. But yeah, in general, I was just really excited to get out of US to Europe and get some, you know, new experience in life. So that's how I ended up in Germany. And in Berlin, I did an internship with an investor. He was an entrepreneur investor, a guy named Michel Brehm. And I worked with him for a couple months. He actually ended up hiring me after I graduated from my master's program. 12 years later, I'm still here. So fell in love with the city, fell in love with the opportunity in tech.
You've been juggling between operator and investor for some time. What have you learned as an operator that influenced your investor mindset now?
Yeah, honestly, this one was a hard one to answer because I actually found that I personally, there was a big mindset switch between the operator and investor roles. Like in my investor job, I think, or in my investor role, I tend to focus a lot more on like big picture, right? Meaningful milestones, like results, right? And as operator, I was mainly focused on solving like problems in front of me, right? Like that's how things get built, like brick by brick by brick. So it was actually a very different lens through which I saw the world, right? As an operator versus investor. And if I were, when I thought about like what areas of overlap there was like meaningful and there was a lot of alignment, I would actually say it was the ability to look at nuance and evidence before there is meaningful results or, you know, a significant amount of data points, right? So I can maybe give one example here. Like when I was at ResearchGate before I joined Target Global, I was with a team at ResearchGate. There were about 50 people when I joined, practically pre-revenue. And right around the time I joined, the commercial topic became one of the top priorities for the company. So we needed to experiment a lot, right? We needed to find a go-to-market strategy. We need to find the message, right? We need to find the ICP. There was so many things to figure out. And because the team there had a, you know, pretty solid culture of being data-driven and evidence-based, we, you know, kind of had an experiments framework through which we can iterate and test a lot. And now as an investor, I kind of look at not just like numbers, right? Not just outcomes, especially if there's kind of an absence of evidence, right? But I look at systems. And I think it taught me a lot to speak with founders and operators about how do you go about solving this? How do you go about thinking, right? It's more like the framework or the rationale or the system or engine that you build rather than like comparing numbers or, you know, something like that, right? If I were to think of the most meaningful kind of takeaway for me personally, it was really around, in absence of like concrete numbers or concrete evidence or so, like what else is there to look at, right? And for me, it was very much like how the team goes about building something or solving problems.
Do you also want to tell us like what ResearchGate does and maybe how big they were when you left? And I would maybe like to focus on particularly like if you remember the day when you decided to leave ResearchGate and to join Target Global.
Yeah. So yeah, 50 people when I joined, about 300 when I left. Company grew from like zero to around 15 million revenue around the time I left as well. So I was there for about 3.5 years. And ResearchGate, high level, was, you know, they wanted to turn the publishing world of scientific research on its head. So at the time, it was called open science. Effectively, the belief was that access to scientific knowledge should be free and available to everyone. And the status quo is the most kind of innovative ideas in science were published in journals, which is quite, you know, how you get in those journals, right? It's a little bit political. And you had to pay a lot of money to subscribe to those journals, right? So if you wanted, I don't know, the journal in biology or microbiology or, you know, whatever, like you needed to pay for access to all that information. So ResearchGate tried to just open up science, right? I thought it was a very, very, very cool mission that could really have, you know, outsized impact in the world. So I was really excited and still was excited the day I left. So it was not so much that I quit ResearchGate. It was a little bit more, you know, I knew two of the general partners at Target Global from a little bit my early career. So Yaron and Shmuel, we worked together at Hassel Platner Ventures. That was the direct investment arm of the chairman of SAP, Hassel Platner. And what I recall from that time period was they were, you know, I was very young. I was super unproven, right, as an investor. And they gave me a lot of confidence and support. Just maybe one example was like, I don't think I was even at the fund for a year. And I met this founder in New York, of all places. I was just like, happened to be in New York at some point in my life. So I met this founder and I was like, this is a fantastic, fantastic entrepreneur. I don't even know why, right? I just have a great feeling about this guy. Like, he's great. And he actually ended up wanting to start his business in Berlin. So there was no product. He was like a solo founder. He's never lived in Europe before. And he wanted to create a company travel, which is super hard, right? But they supported me. They let me do it. They gave me a decent amount of guidance and just kind of pushed me in the deep end and said, like, do it. So I really remembered that. And when they invited me to come back and, you know, they raised the early stage fund for Target Global. And this was around 2018. And they asked me to come, you know, work with them. And it was almost a no-brainer for me. The bigger question for me at the time was, why go back into venture rather than why leave ResearchGate or why work with the folks at Target?
It kind of seems that the best career opportunities or the best teams to work with are with people that really give you so much responsibility that maybe sometimes you feel that you are over your head, but you feel good about it actually because you feel trusted. So then tell us maybe a little bit more about Target Global. I know that you've been with Target Global for 5 years. You've recently been promoted as a partner. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well deserved. So maybe you can tell us a little bit more about Target Global, and then maybe you can tell us, how do you guys assess investment opportunities?
We're a fairly new-ish fund, right? So we started with a growth fund around 2015, had raised and started investing out of the growth fund. 2018, like late 17, 18, we had our early stage fund. And I mean, that kind of followed a big overall goal of wanting to become full lifecycle partners to entrepreneurs. I don't know if you remember kind of the venture scene in Europe, like, let's say 10 years ago. But there were a lot of kind of supportive capital around, but very, very few funds were actually able to do kind of early, right, like pre-seed, seed, A, B, C, right? So like kind of a little bit more on the full venture, you know, side of, or venture capital side of a company's journey. So Target Global really wanted to be that partner, homegrown out of Europe. Today, we're about $3.5 billion in, you know, assets under management. We still have early stage and growth stage funds. We're, you know, kind of two separate teams. And the way we kind of assess opportunities tends to depend on, you know, if you're early stage opportunity or growth opportunity. But kind of overall, we love really amazing stories, right? We love the why now? Why should anyone care, right? Like, how big is this thing? And what we really kind of look out for, especially early stage, but I would also say in the growth stages, are teams that really know their stuff. They need to come with some unique edge, right? Why you? And they're able to tell a very compelling story, right? And we believe, we put a little bit more weight, I think, on this aspect because you're essentially a very resource-constrained entity. Arguably, I think there's two big strengths. There is your speed of execution and how well you can sell your vision, people on board to kind of your side, right? Whether that's investor, your C-level hires, your customers, literally everyone around you. On top of the kind of more basic things like what's the market size and, you know, all of those things, we do also look for the relevancy and why should anyone care? And that real, that storytelling piece around the opportunity.
Do you remember the last amazing story that you've heard that you've been, oh my God, where do I sign?
Yes. I'm not sure if I could share. It was an amazing story. It was actually very recently. Ultimately, it's a company we did not go into for other reasons. It was a, you know, without going into too much detail and also maybe out of respect or privacy of the team there, the whole pitch was like, they essentially put you or put me, my team, in the shoes of a customer and effectively did like a live product demo and essentially treated us like a sales pitch. And it was one of the most fantastic kind of first time pitch experiences that I had. It was visual, it was spot on, it answered all of our big questions. And it was super compelling what they were building on top of the fact that they had performance, right? So they had revenue. It was, they were growing really fast at amazing kind of net dollar retention, right? So all the boxes were getting checked. And while they were, you know, taking you through this, like almost like customer pitch journey, they started sprinkling in like, right, all the key elements of what makes a pitch kind of compelling in the first place, right? All the basic building blocks of a great pitch. So that, you know, was a super, super cool team and story. Ultimately, we ended up not going for it, I think for other reasons. But I must say, just from a pure storytelling perspective, that was really cool.
Let's change gears a bit and let's get personal. What was the most challenging period in your career and how did you overcome it?
You know, it was actually after my second company. So you know, I had two businesses of my own. And after my second startup, that honestly didn't go that well, was still some kind of exit, but it wasn't the best, right? The first one was kind of relatively way more successful than the second one. After that second experience, after experiencing this high, you know, it was extremely disappointing. And I think what was super challenging was I actually didn't know who I really was at the end of that journey, right? I think I've spent like several years just solving problems and executing and selling and doing all the things, right? Hiring and firing and doing all the things that were just necessary to build a business. You know, first company was in Indonesia. So I was also like in an entirely new environment. And, you know, I think it was just a very exhausting time period. So when that kind of high velocity and very, very high input time period ended for me, I was kind of left there in silence. And it was the most frightening silence I've ever experienced, right? It was like, who am I? What do I do now? It was even more challenging, I would say, than the darkest days of building, because I really didn't know. I don't know. It was just kind of one of those emotionally low time periods. And the way, I guess, I got out of it, to be honest, I kind of sat there feeling sorry for myself for a bit. But after that, you know, I just kind of picked myself up again. I, you know, talked to a lot of people, a lot of investors, a lot of operators, entrepreneurs, and, you know, was lucky enough to have some super, you know, helpful, well-intentioned folks around me at the time. And they actually advised me to check out venture capital. I just explored a lot, right? And pretty much in my mind, tried to say yes, at least conceptually, to almost everything that came my way, just to explore and vet and see if, you know, maybe there's an entirely new direction in my life that I could take. And that kind of reignited like the excitement and the, you know, kind of forward-looking picture, and definitely got me out of the slump like pretty quickly.
Thank you very much for sharing that. I guess so much of the identity was wrapped around the business and in a high pace environment, and all of a sudden there's nothing and you don't know who you are.
Yeah.
And I'm actually reading this therapy book because I'm coaching some founders, and I think for founders there's just so many ups and downs. You want to be also a good therapist. And they talk about how when you feel that you don't have options, you have an impoverished model of the world. But mm-hmm. once you see that you actually have more options, then you have a more enriched model of the world. So it's funny how also you kind of detected it as like, yeah, I kind of felt that I don't have options. But once I kind of opened up a little bit and I talked with different people, I saw that actually there are just so many options that I can take. And that's always quite exciting.
Yeah, I really like that. Absolutely.
Tell me about someone that had an impact on your career.
I guess more directly impacting my career were, you know, people like Yaron and Shmuel, who just kind of threw me into the deep end, honestly. Same with Michel Bream, right, who gave me that opportunity. He was the investor of my first and second companies. So, I mean, he knew me for like half a year and decided, hey, like, you should just go and try operating, right? So the people who took big bets on me, I would say, early on, I was completely unproven. They definitely had the biggest impact kind of in that career trajectory. There's another person who, you know, I kind of got the advice early on to not like necessarily recruit, but surround yourself with people who can be like mentors or advisors or role models. And there's one individual in particular, I won't say his name because the nature of his job is working with kind of ultra high net worth individuals. And I think he would, require the privacy, but he would give me some amazing ways to think about decisions. And at the time, it felt really counterintuitive. Like, for example, when I had to decide, you know, should I go to Indonesia? Like, why should I go to Indonesia, right? Like, why there? Why not go to the US and build something, right? It's kind of maybe the more obvious choice. But he would say just things like, Lena, just say yes, go there. And if it doesn't work, you can always go back. What's the worst that can happen, right? I'm like, what do you mean what's the worst that can happen? I can spend, you know? So, I mean, he would just say these things which liberated myself from myself in a way, like, am I overanalyzing, am I overthinking? He definitely was more of a constant support and sounding board in my life, and honestly very instrumental in some of my most key decision-making moments.
How do you decide which people to surround yourself with? And are you still doing this actively today? I don't know, coaches or people that are maybe a couple of steps ahead of you in the VC career? How do you go about it?
That's a great question. And yes, I do. It just kind of changed. Like, I guess I'm more experienced and you know, how, like, after leveling up a little bit more in my career, I think the nature of things I needed guidance on, like, fundamentally changed. I think when I was kind of younger and more naive, right, I just really needed general models to like navigate life. And then kind of the older I got, my kind of needs were way more pointed and way more specific. So I went and started to hire some of those coaches, right? And try to surround myself with people who can give me that support. In my early career, kind of how I vetted people to kind of take advice from, honestly, I was not super aggressive about my filter. My one kind of big filter was, do I respect this person, right? Like, do I admire them? Do I feel that this is someone I could, like, on a kind of values basis, but also on like a monetary success basis, and also from like a quality of life, you know, lens, like someone I really looked up to and wanted to be like, right? And kind of try to, in a way, replicate that path there, right? So that was a bit my filter early on. And I met some super cool people. There was one time when, also we'll keep his name private, I met him in New York, and we were at the Plaza. It's really nice hotel near Central Park. And there was some alumni event going on the top floor of that hotel. And he's like, you know, we had coffee, we paid the bill, and said, look, I'm going to show you something. So he just kind of like led me to the top floor. And there was like security at the door, and he's like, oh, don't worry about it, we're sound check or whatever, you know, and just kind of went all the way up to the front of this massive room and stage, like just acting like he belonged there, right? And picked up the microphone, made a little announcement, something like, you know, sound check one, you know, something like that, and then left. And I was like, what the hell was that? And he's like, look, one thing in life is, if you pretty much act like you belong there, very, very few people will question you. And it was really cool to kind of surround myself with those kinds of people. That taught me really interesting things.
It's almost like taking like the blue pill, you know, like you can do whatever you want. You just have to have the courage And you can do whatever you want, because in the end, no one is going to give it to you on a platter. In life, you just have to go and get it.
Exactly.
And I think this is maybe an attribute of great entrepreneurs. They know this. They know that no one owes them anything. And if the door is open, they'll go through the window.
Yep.
And they will do whatever it takes. And they'll be shameless. They'll just be shameless in doing what's best for them and for the company.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
You're by any means a very successful person. What do you attribute your success to?
Really, really deep question. This also changed a lot for me over the years. There's kind of the honest answer, if I were really honest with myself, right? And there's kind of the answer that I wish would be true. So the answer that I wish would be true was, you know, I'm happy in my life. I have a partner who I love and loves me. I have a great relationship with my family, you know, despite living in like entirely different places around the world. I have fun with my career and the people I work with, right? And that's more of the measure of success that I try to adopt over time and over the years. With that said, though, I think that's easy to say for people who have proven themselves, right? More from a monetary or some kind of respect or hierarchy perspective. And I really try to let go of that model because I think that's exactly the trap I fell into my early career where, you know, if it wasn't a successful company, I was not a successful person and maybe I was not worthy or whatever, good enough, et cetera, et cetera. Deep inside, I still attribute some part of my success or, you know, am I a successful person to monetary gain and, you know, these kinds of wins, right? And I think it'll be something that always somehow sticks with me. I don't know if I can actually really let it go fully, but I'm happy to say that it becomes less and less of a thing that puts me down if I don't achieve it, right? And more of a thing that motivates me to achieve it. I guess that's like the real, you know, honest answer.
Thank you. Thank you very much for being so honest and transparent. I know that we actually had this discussion before starting this interview, but and you wouldn't know like which book to choose, but tell me about one book that had an outsized impact on your life.
You know, I was telling you before we started recording, like I couldn't think of specific books. I could think of authors. I read a lot as a kid. So my mom actually didn't let me watch television as a child. So my way of escaping was reading, you know, being entertained was reading until I got a computer when I was like 12 years old, then it was all internet all the way. No, I still read quite a bit. But some of the authors that I read early on in my life, I don't know why they were exactly impactful. I think mainly it was because it kind of opened my eyes to a kind of fairy tale world in my childhood, right? Like everything is kind of nice and people are nice. And, you know, and reading some of these authors, like, you know, I mentioned Chuck Palahniuk, probably the best title from him is Fight Club, right? Or Jeffrey Eugenides. One of the first books I read from him was Suicides. You know, like Prozac Nation. It was just like this whole genre of books that were kind of, you know, they kind of open your eyes to a bit more cynical side of the world or kind of rebellious ideas about the world that really deeply questions, like, why is society the way it is? Or why are people the way, you know, why are systems set up? Like, why is banking the way it is, right? Why does money even matter, right? So asking some of these super fundamental questions really excited me. And I just kind of fell into this whole, I don't know, this kind of genre of books and authors that, it was a bit dark and a bit cynical. But and to this day, I keep, you know, thinking about certain scenes or certain ideas from these authors. So I'd say in that sense, it had a really big impact.
And if Lena from 10 years ago would listen to this episode, what would you tell her?
I would say just keep going your own path that's completely unique to you. I come from kind of immigrant family, Korean American, first generation. So first generation born in California in America. And I was like, for the longest time, I had it in my mind that I needed to become a lawyer, that I needed to follow this certain path in life. Otherwise, who are you, right? And also from reading those books, right, I really rebelled against this idea that there is some sort of predetermined or there's like a kind of an equation for life that if you solve this equation properly, you'll be successful and happy and all of that. Actually, I thought, okay, if everyone's going to go do this, like my department, I chose philosophy in undergrad. Most of my friends, you know, chose like econ, economics or political science or, you know, something of that business administration. And I just said, like, why not choose philosophy, right? There are like 8 people in my department for my year. It was super small. I went to a public undergrad. It was not small, right? It wasn't some nice private, like, liberal arts school. And my whole family was like, what the hell, you know, like, kind of philosophy factory are you going to go work for afterwards, right? Like, what do you actually do with this? But if I were to, yeah, kind of talk to my younger self, I would say, don't question those kinds of decisions in your life. I think if it feels right for you and you feel some pull towards that path or that thing, just go for it. Just say yes, right? Like what my mentor would say, what's the worst that can happen? You can always walk back out, right? You can always change your mind. So yeah, like don't worry about where the herd goes. Just go to your own path. And I think that's, I was very anxious about that growing up. Like I had a huge chip on my shoulder, right? All my, like some of my friends going into big banks and big law firms and being promoted. And I'm kind of like, you know, sleeping on a couch in my mid-20s. Like, what am I doing with my life, right? So in the end, it turns out, I think, perfectly for everyone. Yeah.
Love it. Follow your own path. There's this Steve Jobs quote that you can never connect the dots looking forward, only looking backwards. So I think following your own path and your own intuition probably reach a point where like, oh yes, now everything kind of makes sense looking back.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
Lena, thank you. Thank you very much for taking the time. It was such a lovely conversation. Very much appreciated.
Thank you so much for having me again, Callan. It was such a pleasure, and I'm really excited to see where you go personally. This is a new journey for you as well, so I'm very excited for you.